Welcome back to Libromania, a podcast for the book obsessed, featuring interviews with contemporary authors, discussions about key figures and movements in literary history, examinations of various genres and current events in the literature world, and the celebrations of all the things that make books wonderful. Bookstores, book design, book collections, and so forth. I'm David Kern. This is Chapter 9, in which I chat with film critics Jeffrey Overstreet and Stephen Gray Danis about some of the very best film adaptations of great works of fiction.
Films that I find most interesting as adaptations are those where the source material takes the artist somewhere that they wouldn't otherwise have gone, but then allows them to say something in their own voice, to express some side of their own creativity that would otherwise have gone unexplored.
Whenever anybody says, well, the book was better, that's almost a worthless statement. When I'm looking at literary adaptations, I assume it's going to be a different thing. And I have to decide, okay, do I value this new thing enough that it's worth talking about as its own work of art? But then it's a separate question to me, does this new thing honor and uphold and embrace the core question or ideal in that original work of art?
Well, just last Sunday, the Oscars were on TV. This year, the Oscars had a lot of controversy about them, and even the final choices for some of the big awards were controversial in and of themselves, shall we say. But be that as it may, I want to talk about one of my favorite subjects in the world of literature. In fact, it's the intersection of two of my very favorite subjects, movies and books. So I wanted to chat with two of my favorite film critics, Jeffrey Overstreet of LookingCloser.org and Stephen Gray Danis of DecentFilms.com. about some of their favorite film adaptations of great works of fiction. This seemed like the best week to do it. We just had this massive Hollywood celebration of movies. Movies have been in the media. People have been talking about them. Even the controversies have been keeping movies in the mainstream media conversation, so to speak. So this seemed like the best time to chat about this very subject. So got online, chatted with Stephen and Jeffrey Overstreet about some of their favorite cinematic adaptations, but we began by discussing what makes a great movie adaptation of a book. Before we get into that question, though, I want to let you know about Jeffrey and Stephen. Jeffrey's been on this podcast before. He was on one of the very first episodes talking about the best movies of 2018. So if you've listened before, you know he is a four-time novelist. He is an award-winning film critic. He's a teacher of creative writing at Seattle Pacific University. And he also wrote a movie-going memoir called Through a Screen Darkly. It's one of my favorite books on movies, in fact. To learn more about Jeffrey, you can head over to lookingcloser.org. Stephen Gray Danis created decentfilms.com in 2000, where he's been posting his film reviews ever since. He's also the film critic for the National Catholic Register and a member of the New York Film Critics Circle. And he is a permanent deacon in the Catholic Archdiocese of New York. To discover his film reviews, head over to the National Catholic Register's website or decentfilms.com. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Jeffrey Overstreet and Stephen Gray Danis. And as I said, we began the conversation by discussing what some of the characteristics are of a great film adaptation. Here it is. Hope you enjoy. Well, first of all, thanks to both of you for joining me. This is an honor to chat about film with both of you, two of my favorite film critics. So I'm going to enjoy this a lot. So thanks for being here.
Oh, it's a privilege.
Thank you so much.
So we're here to discuss film adaptations of novels. Oscar week was last week, and this is a podcast that is primarily concerned with the reading life, I suppose. But those two things, this is the right week to bring those two things together, I think. So I guess my first question then, before we get into your lists of your favorite film adaptations, are pretty simple, I guess. What do you think makes a great film adaptation? And Stephen, I'll turn to you first. Do you have, when you're thinking about this or when you were thinking about your list, were there some principles that immediately came to mind? Or did you have to really dig deep to say, to find some common themes in the films that you chose?
You know, this is a question that I think Jeffrey and I in particular have been wrestling with ever since, almost since the start of our careers in writing about film. And a lot of these questions were raised in particular by the adaptations of The Lord of the Rings by Peter Jackson and other films that were coming out at that time. And so many questions that emerged out of that conversation about the relationship of film to its source material, and you know, what does it mean to be faithful to the source, and is that important, and so forth. These questions we've been kind of knocking them around for a long time, and what I've kind of come up with for myself is when I think of, I mean, first of all, the only ironclad rule of a great adaptation is that you have to make a great film. That's the only absolute. But going a little bit beyond that, I would say that films that I find most interesting as adaptations are those where the source material takes the artist somewhere that they wouldn't otherwise have gone, but then allows them to say something in their own voice, to express some side of their own creativity that would otherwise have gone unexplored. Interestingly, it was actually a song that helped me to first articulate this. I was visiting a friend in California for one of those junkets, Lord of the Rings or something, and he played me a song by the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. It was one of their versions of the Battle of New Orleans. And it has such a weird musical fabric, the way that the singers chew the words as they sing them. And I turned to my friends and I said, this is a cover. Nobody writes that song and performs it that way themselves. Somebody else wrote that. And this is what you get when you play with someone else's material. Mm. And he confirmed that was correct. And so I think that the best movie adaptations, you have something similar happening.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think you have to recognize that the fundamental differences in the medium, you know, a text-based narrative asks the audience to engage their imaginations at a level and in a way that's completely different than watching a movie. You are illustrating the text as you go. Motion pictures, they do, you know, you don't need music, you don't need a cast, you don't even need a narrative to have a movie. For a movie, all you need are images in motion. All you need is cinema, basically, the juxtaposition of images. So you are going to have a tremendously different thing altogether and ask very different things of your audience altogether if you are coming up with something from scratch or adapting a literary work. So you have to assume that whenever anybody says, well, the book was better, that's almost a worthless statement, because you can't, it's apples and oranges. So when I'm looking at literary adaptations, I assume it's going to be a different thing. And I have to decide, okay, do I value this new thing enough that it's worth talking about as its own work of art? But then it's a separate question to me, does this new thing honor and uphold and embrace the core question or ideal in that original work of art? So, I mean, you can talk about something like Children of Men, Cuarón takes a book that he's barely read. I mean, he admitted in interviews that he kind of read the synopsis on the book jacket and decided, well, there's some good ideas there, I'm going to make a movie. So I think of Children of Men, the movie, as a great film, but not a great adaptation, because, I mean, he's fundamentally violating in some ways the convictions that P.D. James had when she wrote the book. The Name of the Rose is the movie that got me thinking about this first. The conversation came up around The Lord of the Rings as this community of film critics was growing. But way back in 1986, The Name of the Rose was a very popular novel, very complicated novel. I tried rereading it last year, and I was bored out of my mind, because the author is, Umberto Eco, is so interested in history and theology that the mystery just kind of feels like an excuse for him to write what he's really interested in. As a movie starring Sean Connery and very young Christian Slater and F. Murray Abraham, it's kind of a Poirot or maybe Brother Cadfael kind of thing. What I noticed about that adaptation is that while it has little to no interest in the deeper questions of the novel, it admits right up front that it does not say based on the novel. It does not say inspired by the novel. It says it's a palimpsest of the novel. And that is a really strange word. Palimpsest is when, I mean, I'm just looking at a Google search definition here. Something reused or altered, but still bearing visible traces of its earlier form. And that seems to fit exactly with what I'm seeing when I watch The Name of the Rose. There are visible traces of Eco's novel, but most of it has been obliterated, and now somebody is writing something almost entirely new over those traces. Mm. So the Name of the Rose felt very, very honest to me as a film in that way. And so I think that a lot of it is semantics. A lot of it is, you know, is this really an adaptation? Hmm. Or is this somebody's effort to make something in celebration of something, some aspect of the book that they liked? And so it gets complicated movie by movie really fast.
Stephen, do you agree with that distinction that he's making? In terms of how he's
I absolutely. And I think that it's very important to recognize that there are multiple ways in which a film can engage its source material, and that approach, what I've called sometimes the random plundering approach, it can make for a very bad film, but it can also make for very good ones. So for me, there are multiple levels. You can try to make a film that is as faithful as possible, or at least following the source material as closely as possible. And that can give you a very stiff wooden adaptation, but it can also give you something very lovely. I'm thinking, for instance, of a movie that I know that Jeffrey and I both value, Watership Down.
Yes.
The animated film, which is not, you know, obviously not a perfectly faithful adaptation. No,
it's drastically abridged. Yeah,
but it's as faithful as possible given the limitations and the approach that they took. You can also try to be faithful in spirit, to honor the essence of the source material while going your own way in various respects. But then there's a third kind of engagement, which I think is very interesting, where the filmmaker is subversive of the source material in some way, where they engage it critically. I'm thinking here, for instance, of Andrei Tarkovsky's Solaris, which honors some of the themes and the ideas in the original novel by Stanislaw Lem, but where Lem really wanted to use the premise of science fiction to take characters and by extension, the reader, to a place where normal human and emotional reactions didn't make sense, where it wasn't possible to have a human response to the things that you were confronted with. Tarkovsky really humanized the same images and the same ideas to come up with something that was really fundamentally different from Lem, and which Lem really didn't like at all, and justly so.
That reminds me of Spielberg's adaptation of Empire of the Sun, where the book is a very, very different thing. But Spielberg saw in that story an opportunity to tell his own story about being caught up in the wonder of movies by telling this story about this kid in a concentration camp being caught up in the glory of warplanes. And so I don't know if he meant to subvert the book, but he took it and sort of wrapped it around what he really cares about, and it became an entirely different thing.
Hmm.
What I think provides an interesting challenge to these kinds of questions, though, is when a film departs from its source material in such a way that you feel like something has been lost and something more interesting has not been put in its place.
Yeah.
I remember when Suzanne and I sat down to watch Neil Jordan's The End of the Affair.
That was exactly the one I was thinking of. Yes.
Based on the novel by Graham Greene. And at this point, neither of us had read the novel. We hadn't read the novel. And as we were watching, we were going along. And when we got to the exact moment in the film where it subverts the whole premise of the novel, Suzanne turned to me and said, "Did Graham Greene really write that?" And I thought, I don't know. So I went to the library and I borrowed the book. And it's amazing how people praise this film for being a faithful adaptation of the end of The Affair, in spite of the fact that The Affair doesn't end. It's really quite drastic.
It's a total betrayal of the heart of that book. It really, really is. Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Well, okay. So I've got, since you mentioned that one, we were going to discuss some honorable mentions and then some of your favorite adaptations, but I am curious. I want to give you each a chance to rail against a couple other ones that maybe you really don't like. Not that I don't want to be too negative, but I'm curious, not because I want you to get a chance to just be negative, but because I'm curious why those particular, I mean, is it simply because they change something or is it primarily in most of the instances for you because they eliminated something of the spirit of the book. So I'm curious if you've thought about if there's any through lines in the film adaptations of books that don't work for you.
I don't want to spend too much of this conversation on this particular author, but I know from experience that Steven's going to back me up on this. He may be thinking about the very same thing, but if I ever have to watch those Peter Jackson Hobbit movies again, I'm going to smash the thing. That too is not just a plundering, not just a betrayal. It's an exploitation of a beloved story, subverting the heart of the story, subverting the themes, subverting the primary motivations of the characters to become just basically a playground for Peter Jackson's CGI aspirations and incredibly crass, excuses for sensational violence. I was so upset by the end of the first Hobbit movie that I swore I wasn't going to watch the other two. I eventually broke down and tried to watch the second one, and I won't come anywhere near the third one. It's such a beloved, wonderful children's story. But what also hurts watching those Hobbit movies is he's also cheapening and diluting and demeaning his own accomplishment in what I think is a rather remarkable adaptation in the first film of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, The Fellowship of the Ring, which surpassed my wildest dreams for a Lord of the Rings movie. So that's a painful subject for me.
Well, I won't make you dive too deep into that right now then. Steven, do you have anything in mind or do you want to just agree with that one? Pile on Peter Jackson before we praise him.
I have a couple of thoughts. I have another example of a film that tries to go the Neil Jordan route of honoring its source material, but fundamentally either doesn't understand it or winds up subverting it for some other reason. Among these is the film Father Brown, sometimes known in the U.S. as The Detective, with Alec Guinness as G.K. Chesterton's clerical sleuth.
I haven't seen.
And Guinness is really quite wonderful in the role. He's a very good Father Brown. And this is the role, by the way, that led to his conversion to Catholicism in playing this priest and in shooting scenes in France. He was really struck by the way that a child approached him and, you know, thought because he was in clerical blacks, he was in a cassock, that he was a real priest and just grabbed him by the hand and was chattering away to him in French. And Guinness didn't dare to talk because he said his French was terrible. But that expression of trust and affection from a child made him see Catholicism in a new light. And he had grown up rather anti-Catholic and it began a process of breaking down his prejudices. So that's a little interesting bit of history to this particular film, which makes me fond of it. But Chesterton's Father Brown is the quintessential English fictional detective in a cassock. And what makes him, what's so subversive about the way that Chesterton writes him is that everyone thinks that he's this kind of pious simpleton who doesn't know about the evils of the world and the evils that lurk in men's hearts. But it turns out that someone who hears confessions for a living knows quite a bit about evil, and he's able to outwit not only the most brilliant criminal minds of his time, but also very often the most brilliant professional detectives as well. And in this adaptation, in The Detective, some of the specific moments in Chesterton's work where Father Brown proves himself to be the smartest man in the room are subverted, and the bad guys wind up getting the drop on him. And you could just see Chesterton really tearing at his hair watching something like that. I also just want to throw out very quickly the adaptation of Charlotte's Web by not the animated one, but the live action one,
the from more recent one.
Yeah, I'm blanking on the name of the studio. They also did Holes, Walden.
Yeah.
Right. And what among the many things that bother me about that is that Walden tried early on to take a very literary approach to children's adaptations that were supposed to be good. And here they're working with a writer, with E.B. White, who's just, he's known for his wonderful prose. And, you know, you have a sentence like this. This is E.B. White describing the barn where Wilbur meets Charlotte. He writes, "It smelled of the perspiration of tired horses and the wonderful sweet breath of patient cows. It often had a peaceful smell, as though nothing bad could ever again happen in the world." Now, if you want to drop that and add images that convey that idea, that's fine. If you want to drop that and have a narrator read something else, come up with something to match that. But this is what they have in the film. Come to think of it, it couldn't be more ordinary. But sometimes, if you take two ordinary things and put them together, they become less ordinary. The barn was full of living things, but that didn't mean it was full of life. Who thinks that that's an improvement on what White wrote?
Right. Yeah.
A screenwriter who thinks they're smart, I suppose.
Yeah. There's another one that is not going to fit into favorites or living nightmares, but that is such an interesting exception and that complicates the conversation about adaptations so much that I think it bears mentioning, and that is perhaps the most obvious title in this entire conversation, Charlie Kaufman's Adaptation, which was such an interesting production. I have never flipped on a movie like I've flipped on this one. The first time I saw it, I had started reading Susan Orlean's book, The Orchid Thief, which I was told this was based on. And I was so upset, although I wasn't so upset that it was clearly not an adaptation of Susan Orlean's The Orchid Thief at all. I was upset because the book is so sincere and earnest and interesting and full of wonderful questions. And this movie was about this reprehensible guy, really, really gross relationships between people and about exploitation and greed and self-absorption, like most Charlie Kaufman films, come to think of it. And by the end, I was so upset, so disgusted with these characters that I was just like, what a betrayal, what a horrible thing. And then the more I thought about it, the more I read about it, the more I realized that, you know, this was called adaptation, but that's exactly right. It's about all the different interests in play when something like this happens, that the studio saw a bestseller and saw an opportunity and hired him because he was a hot writer, but he just didn't connect with the material, but he had signed on to do this. And so the movie becomes about a screenwriter, an aspiring screenwriter, trying to make something of this book, meeting the author, their varying interests clashing, the fact that they are two human beings forming a relationship. You know, I mean, it becomes this very, very meta movie. But now, I mean, now that I've gone back to watch what the filmmaker wanted to achieve, as opposed to what my sentimental attachment to that book is, I see it again as a completely different work of art, one that does engage with the ideas of the Orchid Thief in a very interesting way, but that leaves us with all kinds of questions to take to all kinds of other adaptations. And so I think it was a great contribution to this very conversation that, that people have about the art of adaptation. So I really value that movie now, and I can admire the performances. And now, you know, that I have a better sense of who Charlie Kaufman is, I kind of know what I'm getting into. But you, I recommend that one for anybody who's wrestling with these questions.
Before we get into our your list, one last question about this. Do either of you as critics find that you have to, or find it challenging to disconnect yourself, you know, as critics from the fan version of yourself? Like if you loved Lord of the Rings, say, or The Hobbit or whatever, do you, where's the balance between saying, you know, looking at it open-mindedly, so to speak, as a critic, just viewing the film for what it is, as opposed to bringing your fandom into that? Is that a challenge for you, or have you, or is that, over the years, have you managed to, you know, be experienced enough to make that pretty easy? Stephen, where does that work? How does that work out for you?
There are two very different viewing experiences of an adaptation based on your familiarity or lack of familiarity with the source material. And I think the critic has to be honest about where they fall in that experience. You have to say, this is a story that I've read or that I haven't read, and how that, try to reflect on how that colors your experience of the film.
And you mean be honest with the people who are reading the review. In the review, be honest, not with yourself.
Yes, that's right. But it starts with, you know, if you are a fan of the source material, you know, the critical habit, I think, is to try to watch the film almost in a kind of a split personality way. You see it both through the eyes of a fan, and then you also try to see it, at least, you know, appreciating it for the work of art that it is or is not. And I think that both of those are important. I think you have to give ultimately more weight to the second, because, like I said, the filmmaker's only final obligation is to make a good film. And how that relates to the source material may impact how we receive that film. And that's part of the conversation, but it's ultimately the filmmaker's responsibility is to their vision and to what it is that they want to do. And so you, as long as you don't do something, as long as you don't replace something good in the book with something bad on the screen, then, you know, you're making a good film.
I can think of three examples that sort of map this out for me. One is that I grew up with the Disney version of Winnie the Pooh, and I love it. I love it so much. I love those characters. I love the sweetness of that, the many adventures of Winnie the Pooh, that sort of original collection that I love so much. Just finally came out on Blu-ray this last year, and I jumped on that. But my shout out to my friend Martin Stillion, who is a musician and a writer himself. He can't hold still when that subject comes up, because he feels that the Disney version so misrepresents A.A. Milne's original stories. And I fought that for a long time, and eventually had to admit that he's right, that the books really are about something different. And we really do lose something in the Disney adaptation and the Disney desire to merchandise Milne. So whenever I talk about that movie, I have to admit in writing, if I'm writing about it, that I grew up with this. This is part of my DNA. When I'm writing a novel for adults, the Disney Winnie the Pooh is working on me as I set up my characters in my 100-acre wood of territory. But I also have to say that the books are a beautiful thing that are not well represented by the Disney productions. By contrast, I am not...
Which is quite a statement to make, considering that no writer that Disney ever adapted was as well served and his voice as well preserved as A.A. Milne.
Yeah, that's true.
So if they didn't even get him right, think about all the others.
Right. By contrast, I am not a fan of Philip Pullman's The Golden Compass. When the first book came out, I was a big fan of that because it was so ambitious and so beautifully written, and I loved the characters and the world and where it was going. And then the sequels came out, and it went all the wrong places. And so when the movie came out, I was supposed to write about it, and I had to admit that, well, this movie is not very faithful, ultimately, to Pullman's central ideas, but I don't care. Because I don't necessarily want this film to be a big success, because I don't want more children reading those stories, which I think are subversive and actually harmful for children. And I know I'm going to get mail about that, but that was my experience of that. But then more recently, I got into more complicated territory when a book called Story of a Girl, a young adult novel that was nominated for the National Book Award, was turned into a Lifetime movie. And I love that novel. I would have loved that novel if I had read it with no connection to the author. But the fact is that the author is one of my best friends. So when I read the book and could honestly say, this is a great work of art, I love this, I'm going to use this book in my fiction classes, great. Then it became a Lifetime movie adaptation. And I know the author had concerns but was excited. I had concerns but was excited. She saw the movie, and it was a complicated experience for her, and I won't speak for her on that. But she has written a fantastic essay about the experience of watching her book become a movie made by people she really looks up to, Kira Sedgwick and Kevin Bacon. And that essay is available in Image. If you go to imagejournal.org and search for an article called Adaptation, she narrates her sort of scene by scene, her experience of watching her book transformed, updated to contemporary circumstances and take on a life of its own, and how it became a completely different thing, and what a strange, complicated experience that was for her. I watched the movie and immediately sort of dismissed myself from the community of critics who would be writing reviews, because I didn't think the movie was really worth writing about. It had a couple of interesting performances in it, but it really was kind of a Lifetime movie. And I had hoped for so much better for that book. However, I know it was such a great experience for Sarah, and it brought her book to a larger audience. Yeah. And it was such a growing experience for everyone involved that I'm glad it exists. I'm glad it happened. And I would happily watch it again because of what it makes me think about in this whole adaptation question. But it does go to show this, that some filmmakers aren't the right choices and don't have the right resources to really preserve and honor and promote the achievement of the author. Hmm.
I appreciate that you guys are talking about the complicated nature of the subject, because I think, I mean, like I said at the top, this is a podcast primarily for book lovers. So people who are very, you know, committed to the books that they love often can be harsh about the film adaptations of those books, sometimes justifiably so, and sometimes not justifiably so. But hopefully this conversation will help people maybe be a little bit perhaps more empathetic to the artists who are trying to bring their favorite stories to the screen. But with that, let's dive into to your lists. I asked you each to bring five. Well, we had some honorable mentions, and we can touch on those if you'd like. But for time's sake, we may want to just dive into your top fives, if that's okay. Sure. Jeffrey, I'll go to you first. We'll go from five to one. If you ordered them according to actual preference, as opposed to just randomly. Right? If you have your fifth, what's your fifth on your list and your top five?
Oh boy, I didn't order them. So let me think for a second. Well, of these five, I'm almost inclined to dismiss the Rankin-Bass cartoon version of The Hobbit, just because it is such a sentimental thing for me. I grew up with it as a kid, but I think that for a very strange little animated, it really does honor Tolkien's story beautifully. But that's arguably not a big screen film. So instead, I'm going to throw in Where the Wild Things Are. That is a picture book. Right?
Yeah.
It has this wonderful rhyme that goes with it, but that is a film that loves the book, loves the artwork, and also acknowledges that the audience for a movie would be people who grew up with the book and have a sentimental attachment to it. And so the film, while it is a very different thing, it's deliberately so. It's for adults who need to remember what that book meant to them. It's for young people who need to live in a place that is safe for them to imagine, to live in a place that is safe for them to work out their frustrations and anxieties in the world of make-believe. It is beautifully filmed, beautifully cinematic. The costumes are extraordinary. The music is extraordinary. The performances are strong.
Yeah, it's a great cast.
I've seen it several times now, and every time I love it more. And it's usually a good sign if I feel absolutely compelled to write about something when I see it. And every time I watch this movie, I want to write about it. So that would be number five for me. Are we going to go back and forth, or should I just plow through?
Yeah, we'll go back and forth.
Okay.
So, And I'll go for people, just for some context for people, I'll mention that is the 2009 version that Spike Jonze.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, Stephen, what's your number five?
I honestly don't know if I can rank these the way that you suggested, but I just have mine listed in chronological order. I'm going to start with The Big Sleep, 1946. Howard Hawks, based on the novel by Raymond Chandler, starring Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall.
I'm so glad you mentioned this one.
And what I love about it as an adaptation is that Chandler brings to the project an incredibly labyrinthine plot that you can watch the movie over and over and over, or read the book over and over and over, and still not fully understand everything that happens.
Yeah, kind of
all the different people who are killed and all of the people who did or may have killed them.
Yeah.
But what stands out to you are the individual moments, the snapping dialogue, the chemistry between Bogie and Bacall, the very different chemistry between Bogie and the various antagonists that he goes up against, this kind of riveting electric tension. And the fact that the plot overwhelms you is part of that experience, because you kind of go through it. It's a little bit like trying to ford a raging river, and there's this one rock at the center that you just kind of hold on to, and that's Bogie. He's negotiating this world, he's navigating it, and he has the confidence and the calm and the command to kind of impose some version of sense on everything that's happening. That goes right up until the very last scene, where he's literally improvising the explanation of what happened that he's going to tell the police. You know, what really happened and what's his version of what happened. I saw that film on the big screen in Philadelphia, and
when it first came out.
Obviously not. No, this was in the 1990s. I saw it at Temple University Cinematheque. And I was just so electrified, I immediately went out and bought it on VHS and watched it again the next night because I wanted to try to figure it out.
Wow. One thing I love about that movie, and I'm a huge Chandler fan, but I love the atmosphere that they manages to capture, because you're right. I mean, I've read that novel many times. I don't really know what the plot is. I don't really know. I mean, it doesn't matter. Exactly. It's almost the point that you don't know what's happening, but the atmosphere.
Do you know the famous story about Hawks calling up Chandler to ask him about a particular murder or a particular plot point?
No, I didn't know that.
So at one point during the filming, Hawks gets Chandler on the phone and he says, "So we're trying to shoot the scene and I'm not sure I follow. I think it was a murder." He said, "Exactly who was it that killed this person, or how did this thing?" And Chandler, this is the legend, this is the story, Chandler snapped, "How the hell should I know?" and hung up on him.
but one of the things that Chandler's so good at atmosphere, and I think that Hawks and Bogart, and that, you know, in his acting, even they managed to capture that sort of sleazy atmosphere that's in the book without making it, you know, unwatchable. And I've heard that there is talk of doing an adaptation now, and I mean I don't know why we'd need one, but one of the reasons why I don't think we need one is because I fear that people would be, you know, they'd let themselves be a little bit too carried away with trying to capture the atmosphere in a way that might do a disservice to the characters in the novel.
They try
to do too much with it, I think, now. So it might have been the perfect time to adapt a novel like that. Well, anyway, okay. So number four for you, Jeffrey, what's your number four? We could talk, we could talk about each of these for their whole podcast on each of them. So we got,
I was going to say, now I know what I'm going to prioritize next time. I can just watch whatever I want. I haven't seen that in a long time and I've never read it either. So, I should mention that with this list here, I only chose from among films where I know the literary source very, very well. Mm. So I'm disqualifying some of my favorite films like Blade Runner, which is an adaptation of Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Life?
Yeah, yeah.
Weird Little Book. The movie is, again, loosely based on it, but one of my top 10 films of all time. Babette's Feast, similarly. I've read the short story. I don't remember the short story very much. The movie is among my all-time favorites, but I just don't think I can talk much about the adaptation of it. So in that case, for four, I'm going to say No Country for Old Men. Cormac McCarthy is very, very difficult to adapt to film. I think The Road proved that.
Yeah.
I think the fact that Blood Meridian, thank God, has not become a movie yet proves that. I hope it never does.
Yeah, that would be
brutal. No one should have to sit through that on the big screen. But when I read No Country for Old Men, I read it right when it came out, and I remember remarking to my wife as I read the opening chapters, man, these two... This married couple in the opening chapters, when they talk to each other, I hear Nicolas Cage and Holly Hunter. I hear Raising Arizona. I would almost swear that McCarthy is a Coen Brothers fan because this dialogue is sparking like the Coen Brothers. And it was, I think, 2 weeks later that the announcement came that the Coen Brothers were going to make No Country for Old Men. I was like, I think this was a plan all along. I think McCarthy wanted to work with them and he wrote something that he knew they would love. I may be wrong about that, but it turned out so brilliantly. That movie works so well. It honors the book powerfully. It preserves the most audacious literary moves that McCarthy makes in that book, especially the ending, which subverts any Western gunslinger story that I know. And it just speaks powerfully right into the zeitgeist, I think, right into this sense of an unraveling of the West, Western ideas and democracy in America, and the consequences of the idolization, or the idolatry, I guess is the better word, of the gunslinging hero. So I think that's a great representation of the book. I recommend both of them very much, but not for different reasons. I think that the central ideas are preserved very well. And the movie is just such a masterpiece as far as sort of Hitchcockian suspense and editing, casting, everything. So I love that book-movie combination.
One thing I love about the Coen brothers is the way they work so hard to preserve the language in the books that they... that they adapt, even in, you see in True Grit as well, where there's, you know, it's in some ways it's a Coen Brothers screenplay, but it's certainly also a Charles Portis screenplay. It's so true to the novel that Charles Portis wrote.
I was tempted to say that one, and I think it's much truer to the book than the original True Grit movie. So
absolutely. Stephen, does No Country show up on your list?
No, and I'm not particularly a fan of No Country, although I honestly did consider putting True Grit on my list, which I love because it does that thing of taking the Coens someplace where, and it's hard to say where the Coens' own resources will take them, but Portis's very specific language and the biblical allusions and the cultural richness of it, I think, is something that has informed the Coen sensibility even when they aren't adapting Portis. And I think in coming to this particular novel, to True Grit, they had an opportunity to be almost more Coen-y than they are in many of their other films. And I think it's just a really fantastic marriage of a source and the filmmakers who are really right to adapt it. But I didn't put True Grit on my list. I have a couple other films that I was debating which of them I was going to talk about. I was thinking about talking about Robert Bresson's Diary of a Country Priest, based on a novel by Georges Bernanos, which is very faithful in many respects to the scenes and to the themes that it takes from the novel, and really finds an extraordinary cinematic idiom to explore the fundamental idea that the novel is concerned with, which is the workings of grace in the world and how you express grace, the invisibility of grace in a novel, and how you express it with images on a screen are very different questions. But there's a correspondence between them. And I think that that's a very interesting book and movie combination as well. But I think I'm going to mention something else instead. I'm going to cheat. And I'm going to mention an adaptation for something that is not a novel and which I haven't read. But I think it almost doesn't matter. Alfred Hitchcock's The Wrong Man, 1956, based on the true story of Christopher Emmanuel Balestro by Maxwell Anderson, a book that I don't even know if it's in print. It is a nonfiction story about the real case that inspired this film. And what I find, I understand, although I haven't read it, I understand that the movie does very faithfully follow its source material with respect to the aspects of the story that it adapts at all. There's a lot that's left off the screen, a lot of the police procedure and so forth, because the story is told from Manny's point of view. Manny is played by Henry Fonda. And what I find fascinating about this as a work of adaptation is that Hitchcock approached this film with, he was so struck by the particulars of this true story that a lot of his cinematic mannerisms and idioms and interests kind of evaporate. He doesn't do the mordant humor that he does in a lot of his other films. He doesn't do a lot of the ticks and tricks that we think of as Hitchcockian. He's trying to do something different. And what he finds in that kind of stripped down version of Hitchcock, I think there's a purity to it that you really see the essence of who he is as a filmmaker in the telling of this very simple, straightforward story in its attempt to be as true as possible to the facts of the case. And one of the things that comes through is the spirituality of Hitchcock. You know, a lot has been written about Hitchcock as a Catholic filmmaker, and there are elements of Catholic piety and a deeper and broader way of Catholic sensibility going throughout his work. But in two films in particular, which came out very close together, I Confess, and this film, The Wrong Man, I think you find the spirituality of Hitchcock as an artist more explicitly expressed than anywhere else in his work. In fact, the climax of this film turns on an answer to prayer. And Hitchcock expresses that with a dissolve. It's the master shot of the film. It's an amazing shot, and it is an affirmation of that same kind of interaction of grace in the world that I think that Bresson was trying to express in a very, very different idiom in Diary of a Country Priest.
So Jeffrey, you've done two. So what's your third one?
All right, for my third one, I think we mentioned this earlier, but I am going to say Watership Down. A lot of the reasons why I think we've already covered in talking about some of the other films, but again, that's a story I grew up with. It's the most important novel to me in my life as a storyteller. And I would suspect I'm sentimentally attached to it, but every time I watch it, I think this exactly captures the spirit of the story. They honor that Watership Down is a story not just about animals trying to survive, not just a wartime story that reflects Richard Adams' wartime experiences the way that C.S. Lewis and Tolkien's stories manifest their own wartime experiences. It's also a powerful story about storytelling, about the role of mythology in shaping communities, about the role of mythology in giving us a glimpse, as Tolkien would say, of the ultimate story, which no other genre but mythology or fantasy enables us to access, because no other genre allows us to have the audacity to say we can see the full picture. We can get glimpses of how things are ultimately going to turn out, because that can't be based on our personal experiences. We have to step into make-believe for that. And I think Watership Down captures that in this powerful climactic sequence when the line between the mythological world and the real world blurs, and you have characters from the mythology speaking directly into, I put quotes around this, the real world, to expose the fact that there is no division. And it also has a very a powerful perspective on death that I have a hard time finding an equivalent for in literature, where the figure of death that has seemed so evil and threatening and villainous through the course of the story is ultimately revealed as more of an agent of change, not so much the enemy of the story, but the one that enables characters to make choices for causes larger than themselves, and the one that absolves and enables a character to surrender the future of the people he loves so much to them, so that he can move on to his quote unquote next adventure. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a fantasy novel for adults, but I'm so grateful I read it when I was 10, and so grateful that I saw the movie as soon as it came out, because it has also taught me the power of the visual medium of cinema. I fell in love with the animation there and learned to draw by trying to copy the images I had seen in the movies of Watership Down and the Rankin Bass adaptation of The Hobbit. I should also mention that Angela Morley composed what I think is one of the most gorgeous scores I've ever heard for a film. So it's such a marriage of, it's such a collaboration of all of the things that make a great film and that make great animation, and yet it completely honors the heart of the story in ways that I don't even want to talk about the new Netflix adaptation.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
I'm no longer worried about the Netflix adaptation eclipsing this one. I think in time, I think it's already clear that it doesn't hold a candle to Martin Rosen's achievement here.
This is from late 70s, right? 77, 78, something like
78,
that?
78, actually.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Who is it? Is John Hurt that's in it?
John Hurt is the voice of Hazel. Absolutely. Okay. It's a who's who of sort of British talents of the time. The way the Netflix version is a who's who of, you know, John Boyega and James McAvoy, et cetera, now.
Yeah. Yeah.
The great Michael Hordern is the narrator and also the voice of Frith, the sun god. So, it's quite a time capsule.
Steven, does that show up on your list?
I specifically avoided Watership Down because I knew that Jeffrey was going to talk about it. Jeffrey and I know each other well enough, I think, to be able to anticipate some of our choices. And I know how important that film was for Jeffrey as an adaptation. I really wanted to hear him talk about it. And I think we just heard why.
Yeah, yeah. What's your number three?
So for my number three, I also picked a children's novel that was made into a really wonderful film, one of my all-time favorite children's films, and one that I enjoy watching very much as an adult. Babe, 1995, directed by Chris Noonan, adapted from the novel by Dick Kingsmith, and co-written by with the producer George Miller. That is
a very interesting piece of work by George Miller, given his other work.
And I didn't include this on my list because I wanted to hear Steven talk about this.
It's really, first of all, a wonderful marriage of source material with filmmakers, precisely because George Miller has this fundamental darkness to his work, which he injects just the right amount of that into a story that I think, you know, as much as I enjoy the novel by Dick Kingsmith, it's a little thin, it's a little light. And the more menacing and troubling aspects that Miller, I presume it's Miller, injects into the screenplay that he co-wrote with Noonan makes the film something much richer and more substantial. This film came out the same year as Toy Story from Pixar, a movie that completely changed the landscape of American animation and entertainment. And what the two of them have in common is the creation of a cultural world of anthropomorphic characters that makes sense for the kind of thing that they are. But here's the thing. Toy Story had one toy box culture for all the toys in Andy's room. All the toys have basically the same outlook. They have different accents, you might say, but they all have fundamentally the same way of looking at the world. What's so fascinating about Babe is how this pig from outside the sheep farm comes to this farm, and the sheep have one worldview, and the border collies have another perspective. And then there's Ferdinand the duck and the cat Duchess. Each animal sees life on the farm from their own point of view. And it's all of these perspectives are very limited. So there are elements of prejudice that grow up between the characters. The sheep regard the dogs as vicious wolves. The dogs regard the sheep as stupid and just needing to be dominated and bossed around. And Babe, because he comes from outside this world, isn't limited by any of these perspectives, and he's able to transcend these social divisions and to be a unifying force on the farm. You can't help comparing Babe with another much more famous story about a talking pig on a farm, Charlotte's Web by E.B. White, which we touched on before. And I love Charlotte's Web, but when I read it to my children, I can't help noticing that Wilbur is a very passive protagonist.
Yeah.
He does almost nothing throughout the story. Until the very end, when he bribes Templeton the Rat to save Charlotte's egg sack as a way of thanking the spider who saved his life. Babe is a much more dynamic protagonist. He takes his fate into his own trotters, and he challenges the preconceptions of the other characters. And it's realized with such gorgeous cinematography. Hoggett Farm is a masterpiece of production design. It's a character unto itself. The music is it's perfectly scored, and Noonan shoots it with such restraint, and it has there's a spirit to this film that is unlike any other film that I've ever seen, and it's something that I really treasure.
Babe for me was the movie that made me want a border collie when I was growing up. And also made me think of James Cromwell in a, you know, every time I see a James Cromwell movie, that's what I think of. Of course, I was probably, I was like 10 years old when that came out. But, you know, I'm really glad that you both mentioned these two movies, Watership Down and Babe, together. Because in my home, I've got, my oldest is 7, my boys are 6 and 7, and then younger. But that these two movies have been not a debate really, but the two movies that we've been discussing, when do we let them watch them? Are they too dark? You know, so you mentioned them both in connection with each other, which I'm sure you probably planned there, Stephen, but those are the two movies that we're kind of like, we have in our back pocket. We're trying to find the perfect time to watch them. And I know everybody's kids are different and all that kind of stuff, but when would you watch those two? When would you watch these movies, each of you, with children? When would you say, I mean, 6 and 7 seems a little young for both. Would you agree with that?
I think kids are all very different from one another. And right, as a parent, you have to know the sensibilities of your own kid. What I have found in my family, you know, we have seven kids, and that tends to, the younger kids tend to grow up a little bit more quickly, having right, so many yeah. older brothers and sisters when it comes to entertainment choices. My children have grown up with Watership Down and with Babe from the time that they were very, very little. And okay. I would not, yeah. So for me, there is no too young to watch these movies.
Okay.
Jeff, yeah, I would agree with that. You know, when I was writing my novels, fantasy novels, I was writing them for adults, and I get more letters from 10-year-old girls than I do adults telling me which characters should get married should I ever write another sequel. But I would have been horrified to hand those books to 10-year-old girls when I was writing them, because I thought I was writing about subject matter that was just too too far beyond what they were ready to wrestle with. And I was very, very wrong. Then again, you know, a high school English teacher gave me a copy of Watership Down when I was 10. And so many people are like, what a horrible, horrible thing to do. Was it, did that traumatize you? And so many people tell stories about being traumatized by seeing the movie of Watership Down when they were a small children, thinking that it was like a cute Disney movie. And then they see rabbits tearing each other's throats out. But I, you know, I can't deny that when I was earning my master's degree, my primary essay, the one that I worked on the most, was about what a formative experience it was for me to dwell on that book and that movie as a child, and how that had a tremendous influence on my Christian faith, even though that is not Richard Adams' priority, I don't think. So again, yeah, I agree with Stephen. It really depends on the child. It really depends on the family and the kind of context and tools that have been given to the child for what to do when they're reading something that they may not yet understand.
All right, we're down to the final two here. So, Jeffrey, what is your, you didn't do them in order. So pick one of your final two here for us.
This is painful because as the conversation goes on, I keep thinking of things I've forgotten. I'll cheat again here. I could go one route and go to, you know, one of two movies that transform biblical narratives in ways that get people talking. I know this is one that Stephen would not choose or want to talk about, but we could definitely spend time on The Last Temptation of Christ. That's a very complicated, challenging book, very complicated, challenging movie. I think they complement one another pretty well. Not a movie I frequently recommend to people, but my experience wrestling with the questions of that book and movie was also very instrumental in my faith at a very difficult time for me. Similarly, Aronofsky's Noah may not be a great film, but boy, did it inspire a great conversation. And I don't want to wrap this up without recommending an essay at the website Bright Wall, Dark Room by my friend Lauren Wilford, who graduated from Seattle Pacific here. She wrote an essay called Sacred Texts and Ruined Childhoods on Aronofsky's Noah. And it is an ambitious, sweeping essay about literary adaptation, about the things we love on the page and how that carries over to our responses to the movies. And ultimately, it becomes an argument for the importance of being open to grow and change along with interpretations of stories. And it's the best treatment of Noah that I've seen. But since I can't say I love either of those movies, I love the conversations around them. Instead, I'm going to veer more in the direction of Francis Ford Coppola and
there's a few to choose from here.
and Stanley Kubrick too. It would be a toss-up between Apocalypse Now and 2001: A Space Odyssey. 2001: A Space Odyssey, I guess, is well represented by the movie to some extent, but the movie is, I think, so much more than the book. It is cinematic poetry of the highest level, and like Apocalypse Now, a harrowing look at human depravity and where our ambitions are leading us when our ambitions get ahead of our consciences. But more importantly to me, Apocalypse Now is the one because I love Joseph Conrad's novel so much, and then the movie completely recontextualizes that into, you know, the mess of the Vietnam War. And I think the spirit, this is a great case of the movie not following the text to the detail very much, but drawing from the voice of that text and honoring the spirit of that text so well, so that once again, you have a story of a soldier winding, you know, down a river through the jungles to face his own worst version of himself, as well as a picture of what happens when American ideology is separated from conscience and from faith. And you end up with the pursuit of happiness leading to absolute madness. And I feel like the aesthetic experience of Apocalypse Now on the big screen, that's the most impressive experience I've ever had in a theater. I got to see Apocalypse Now at the Cinerama here in Seattle with rock concert level sound. And I've never experienced a movie so immersively as I did that one. And, it always leads me back to the novel. It always helps me dig deeper into the questions of the novel. And so I just think it's one of the greatest films ever made. I can't say I admire the choices the filmmaker made in the creation of the movie. If you watch the documentary Hearts of Darkness, you will come away very conflicted about the film itself and the choices that went into it. But we have to deal with the artifact, right? The thing that is left. And I can't deny that it is so valuable as a context for conversation and reflection.
Mm. Does that show up on your list, even one of your final two?
No, and I'm not as much a fan of that film as Jeffrey is. I think it's interesting, though, that Jeff turned at this point in the discussion to the possibility of talking about biblical adaptations. Aronofsky's Noah is a movie that I would say that I love, not without reservations, but perhaps I'm not as able as Jeff is to distinguish between my enthusiasm for the film and my enthusiasm for the discussions that it occasioned, the ideas that Aronofsky explores in that film, I found really electrified me and inspired me to do more writing than any film has in a very long time. I wrote at least four pieces inspired by that film. I wrote a theological reflection.
Halfway to a book.
Pasolini's The Gospel According to Matthew is another very interesting film with regard to the question of what the text does versus what the movie does. Pasolini set for himself the challenge of not having any spoken words other than the words that are in Matthew's gospel. And so wherever Matthew has narration, Pasolini has to try to express that with just visuals. And so you have a rather inexplicable image if you don't know the story of, you know, Mary standing there, obviously pregnant, and Joseph looking at her and, you know, wondering what to do. And so one of the most interesting explorations of cinema as a medium when it comes to the task of adaptation. But the film that is actually on my list, my number four film in chronological order, is The Miracle Maker, 2000, by Stanislav Sokolov and Derek W. Hayes, with a brilliant script by Murray Watts. And what I love about this telling of the story of Jesus, which I watch every year at Easter time with my family every single year, is the incredibly graceful way that it manages all of the challenges of adapting the story of Jesus for the screen today, which includes, first of all, cutting through the dullness of familiarity and helping viewers who have heard these stories all their lives to experience them in a new way, while also illuminating the material for the less knowledgeable viewers, for the more casual viewers, because there's so much that the gospel writers take for granted that you know that has to be expounded upon. You have the tensions among the different gospel accounts. You have sensitive issues around the portrayal of Jewish authorities in 2,000 years of anti-Semitism. There is the question of how to portray Jesus himself, how to convey someone who is divine while you only have the human and the visible to work with. And I don't know that any adaptation of the story of Jesus handles all of these issues as well as The Miracle Maker. One of the challenges that the filmmakers had was that they were working with a split team of animators, with a team of cell artists in Wales and a team of stop motion puppeteers in Russia. And they had used both of these techniques with previous adaptations that were Old Testament shorts, but they wanted to combine them into one narrative here. And how do you do that? They came up with an absolutely brilliant solution that illuminates the biblical text by using stop motion for events that happen in that are objective, as you might say, that are what the characters see as they're walking along. And then they segue to cell animation for the parables of Jesus, for flashbacks and memories, and for other for the temptation in the wilderness as Jesus has been fasting for 40 days and he's tempted by the devil, to suggest some kind of altered consciousness. And that technique becomes a tool of commentary when it comes to the resurrection appearances of Jesus, which are depicted with stop motion. So this is really happening. This is not just a religious experience. Jesus is really standing there. The screenplay is simple enough for children and yet sophisticated enough for theology and Bible students. It's unbelievable how much information is packed into such short scenes and such short lines that you can watch at any age but still there's so much information being conveyed.
I didn't realize the cast was as great as it is. I mean, Ralph Fiennes, Julie Christie, yeah. William Hurt, Ian Holm, Richard E. Grant, Miranda. That's a who's who.
It's an amazing cast, and especially Ralph Fiennes as Jesus is just wonderful. The authority of the kind of person that you would be willing to just drop everything and follow. And yet he's also warm and approachable. And I can't think of any Jesus in any other film that is both of those things. He also, as he gives his teachings, as he does the parables, he sounds like he's speaking off the top of his head. It's a really wonderful performance.
It's a good time of year to mention that movie.
It's kind of remarkable too, because at the time, the other main reference point people had for Ralph Fiennes was Schindler's List, where he's a monster. So I remember seeing, his name attached to it and thinking, well, that's interesting. And then seeing the film and just thinking, that's when I realized what an extraordinary actor he is. That his range was so great.
What a career he's had too. Okay, so let's see. We're down to our final movies, right?
Yeah.
Jeffrey, what's your final movie on this list?
I'm nervous because I know Steven, and I can't help but wonder if we're on the same one.
Don't tell me.
No. We're going to have to talk about this later.
Do you want to just say them at the same time? Countdown.
I have a prediction of Steven's top five, and I've done really, really well so far. But it could be one of two things, so I'm not sure. My number one is A River Runs Through It.
Okay. Which is a great film and a great adaptation. Take it away.
Okay, good. That tells me what your number one is then, but okay, let's go.
You might be mistaken. I went a little counterintuitive.
Okay, all right. So Norman MacLean's novel, I love it more than I can say. I use it whenever I teach fiction. It's if a prose poem could be extended to a novella or a novel, I mean, I think he just about accomplishes that. It's such a beautiful story. It feels like a parable or a Bible story to me, even though it's set in the United States, in Montana. The opening lines of the book so beautifully set up the whole novel by talking about this convergence of rivers and by talking about this pastor whose life is emerging of his passion for the Bible and his passion for fishing. You have a marriage of the intellectual discipline of studying and interpreting the Bible and the aesthetic immersion in nature and beauty. And it basically gives you a map of a country which, if you can access it, you are living a full life. There is no separation between the gesture of casting a line when you're fishing and the endeavor of inquiring what God has to say to you today in the Bible. And then you have this fracture, this separation of brothers. The use of the phrase "the favorite" in the opening paragraphs of this book not only connect it to Bible stories in which the issue of the favorite son, broke history, but also the movie celebrates MacLean's language by Robert Redford's narration, which is gorgeous. But he doesn't do too much of it. This is not an A lot of cinematic adaptations are actually just sort of elaborate illustrated versions of the book where they rely on the text and then provide pictures. This is completely cinematic in that, stretches of the film are almost a silent movie, just savoring the beauty of Montana, so much so that Montana has suffered because of the influx of tourists trying to find the places that this movie brought to such vivid life on the screen.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I've read articles about the locations of this movie and how they are not what they once were because so many people sought them out after this movie opened. The casting couldn't be more brilliant. I mean, Brad Pitt being cast as the young rebellious son was perfect, but it was also eerie in how much he resembled a young Robert Redford in that movie. It was as if this movie was so personal to Redford that he was reconciling with a younger version of himself in this story. Craig Sheffer, who strangely disappears from the movie world after this film. I think he shows up in a couple of like sort of B movies after this, but he's very, very good, very solid as the main character. And I think the greatest casting genius here is having Tom Skerritt play the Presbyterian minister, the father. There is a scene of him with his two young sons sitting on the riverbank that is so graceful. Such a beautiful portrait of fatherhood and of a father recognizing that his sons are growing up, that it just defies description. So it wraps up with text straight from the novel. And you also have to admit that this is MacLean adapting his own life experience into a novel. A lot of people would classify this book as a memoir. But it closes with those gorgeous lines that... MacLean's talking about his memories, and he says, eventually all things merge into one and a river runs through it. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of those rocks are timeless raindrops. Under the rocks are the words, and some of the words are theirs. I am haunted by waters. In that you get the weight of the grief of this character lamenting a loss and the weight of his father's influence and the weight of his heavenly father's influence. The fact that under the impressions of this particular story, this particular person's grief, those raindrops, you have the rocks, you have the timeless truths that his experiences illustrate. And then beneath the rocks are the words. And he means that in every sense of the word of the logos underneath the rocks, is Christ. I am so moved by this film every time, and it seems to unfold with just effortless grace and simplicity. It does not feel like a strained attempt to capture a literary classic in a film. It really does live up to its name. And when it came out in 1992, there were so many other great films that I think it was down like number 15 on my list for that year. But as the years have gone by, it is at the top of my list for 1992 and high on my list of all-time favorites. So that's why I chose that one.
Mm. Yeah, that was a good year, wasn't it?
It was.
All right, Steven.
I think I'm right. We'll see.
What's your final one?
I'm going to surprise you. That was, first of all, just let me say, that is a great film, A River Runs Through It, and that was a beautiful distillation of its virtues as cinema and as adaptation, Jeffrey. One film that I consciously steered away from, not because I thought you were definitely going to pick it, but because I thought you might, and I know it's a film that we both esteem very much for its merits as cinema and as adaptation, but which also over the years we've come to appreciate more some of its limitations, is Peter Jackson's Fellowship of the Ring.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah.
Not the fifth film on my list. And I do want to stress that I created this list in chronological order. So it's the most recent film that I'm going to be talking about. I know it's a film that Jeff fully shares my enthusiasm for, although I probably have a greater appreciation for it as adaptation. Last year's Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
I scratched that off the list because I spent so much time talking about it the last time I talked to David here.
Okay, there you go. It all worked out.
Yeah.
From the demented geniuses, Chris Miller and Phil Lord. I have been a Spider-Man fan from my earliest childhood, and in a way that transcended my attachment to all other superheroes. I identified so very hard with Peter Parker. And I have loved every screen version of this character that I've ever seen. But here in this film, the fundamental ideas behind the story of Spider-Man, from its roots, but also as it's developed over the years, as storylines have fractured and stories have been retold and reinterpreted, most recently in the Spider-Verse series, which originally explores all of these different spider people in all of these different universes within a multiverse. What the filmmakers have done in this film is to use the medium of animation in a way that it's never been used before, ways that it's never been used before, to explore the possibilities of this kind of character and this kind of story in a very powerful way. I just watched the film again last night, and I was struck watching it that the most important three words in the film are said over and over by the characters to one another. And those words are, "You're like me."
Yes.
So
yes.
these spider people experience this moment of connection. They set off one another's spider senses, and they recognize that here's someone who is able to respond to them in a way that no one else that they've ever met has done. And this is such a powerful and profound metaphor for an experience that has many different forms. The first time that I encountered another Spider-Man fan, I had that moment. I had that "you're like me" moment. We both love this character. We both love this mythology. We both love these stories. C.S. Lewis talks very profoundly and movingly about this in the Philia chapter in the Four Loves, the story on the chapter on friendship, and that connection when you thought that you were the only one, and then you realize that you're not. But in this particular story, it has another dimension. And this is something that I have come to appreciate writing about film. You know, that when I was growing up, my childhood, my big screen experiences, and I spent a lot of time in the movie theater as a boy, was full of heroes who looked like me. You know, I had Luke Skywalker. I had Captain Kirk. I had Superman. And I went to school in mostly minority neighborhoods growing up, and my classmates were people who did not have that experience. You know, if you were in my class and you were African American, you had Lando Calrissian, and who else? You know, if you were Asian, you had Bruce Lee, if you could find him on Channel 11 on a Saturday afternoon, and who else? And here's a movie that allows so many viewers and children who have been growing up in this age of overwhelmingly dominant superhero movie culture, it's just been absolutely excluding almost anything else from popular culture for 10 years now. I know that Jeff and I share a sense of oppression by just how much superhero culture is dominating popular cinematic discussion in the United States at this time. And even so, the vast majority of these characters are white guys. Here's a movie that offers children something different, and it offers me something different. It offers another cinematic perspective for family film animation on the father-son relationship. I mean, it's a very, very rare movie that allows a father and a son to have the kind of bond that we see here between Miles Morales and his father. Now, it's a somewhat contentious relationship, as father-son relationships often are, but there's something much deeper. And what I noticed this past time watching it, because I had also recently watched from the same filmmakers their film made 10 years ago, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, is that in both of these films, the potential of the son to unlock his true power to reach his full potential is only unleashed through the father's affirmation of faith in his son and admiration for what he can do. Oh, it isn't until the hero of Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, it isn't until his father holds up his lab coat and gives it back to him that he's able to come into his own and take on the challenge of the weather monstrosity that's been unleashed by his science and the town's appetites. It isn't until Miles' father, standing outside his dorm door as he's webbed up in a chair, unable to move, unable to speak, unable to respond to his father with this door between them. It's a, as Walter Shaw points it out in his review in Film Freak Central, it's an amazing metaphor for the kinds of barriers that do come between fathers and sons. But his father tells him that he sees the spark in him, that there's something that he makes him so proud and that it's his gift. That's the moment when Miles is finally able to unleash his power. And that is, that kind of moment comes along so rarely in family films, especially in American family films. That is a moment that I really treasure. And it's just, it's one magnificent moment in a really stupendous film.
Mm. Yeah. Oh man, I just want to keep talking about that now for another hour. I'll have to hold back. But yes, I gotta say, Stephen, I'm astonished. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more on your choice. I mean, I have spent decades listening to you talk about A Man for All Seasons.
Oh yes,
with Fred Zinnemann's film.
It was on my list. I did absolutely consider it, and I love, that is a play that I love. I love the play and I love the adaptation. I for me, the only reason I didn't bring it up was that I didn't think that it brought as much to the discussion of how an adaptation can transform its material. Because the play is already written for dramatic presentation. Right. It's written with the understanding that we're going to be looking at actual actors standing in the same room together and speaking these lines. And I love the play so, so much. And I love the film so, so much. But for this particular discussion, I just didn't think it had as much to talk about.
Yeah, I think A Man for All Seasons and similarly, Vanya on 42nd Street are about as perfect an example you can get of a movie that captures the full power of the text of a play, the lines are so well spoken by everyone involved that it's just a perfect translation of a stage play to a cinematic medium. But anyway, I didn't want to let this go without at least mentioning that, because I know it's important to Stephen and I both, but yes. I understand your reason for holding back on it too.
I was thinking similarly about The Third Man, which is one of my favorite movies. Mm-hmm. But that's a movie that Graham Greene basically wrote the novella, or I guess it's a novella. He basically wrote it once he'd already been commissioned with the screenplay, I think, and he wrote it as an experiment. So he basically wrote the novel to be cinematic. So I don't know that that's would fit into the conversation as well. It seems to be doing some of the same things as A Man for All Seasons.
We should probably also note, I mean, I note with some chagrin as I look back over everything we've talked about, that we haven't talked about a single woman adapting a text. And that, I think, is more evidence of a problem in the industry that is ongoing. Case in point, our recent Oscar ceremony.
We could have talked, for instance, about Deborah Granik's Winter's Bone and also Leave No Trace, which are based on
novels. We could have talked about Emma Thompson's beautiful adaptation of Sense and Sensibility for Ang Lee. There are great examples out there. Unfortunately, there just aren't enough of them. And I wish we were here. I so wish we were here talking about Ava DuVernay and A Wrinkle in Time.
But we are not. Yeah.
I purposefully didn't bring that up during the negative section.
Yeah. I mean, I was really, really rooting hard for that. And that was one where I was entirely prepared for the film to be something fundamentally different from the book, but still hopefully honoring the spirit of the book, or at least doing something wonderful in place of the book.
Yeah.
And I just wasn't able to, I wasn't able to find what I was looking for.
To be fair, I said Ava DuVernay, she directed it, but the writer was Jennifer Lee. So,
I'm glad you mentioned Leave No Trace. I didn't realize until very recently that that was a novel, but that probably is my favorite.
Story of My Abandonment.
Okay, yeah, that's the that was the movie from last year that has meant the most to me, that I've spent the most time thinking about. So that might mean that it's my favorite movie of the year. I'm not sure exactly what it means, but that's the movie that the individual moments and, you know, just certain images have been ingrained in my head. And I don't know if it's because I watched it about a week after my first daughter was born back in November. So that might be something, there might be that sentimental sort of attachment to it, but that's a great movie. I'd have to read the book.
I'm going to correct myself. Fran Walsh adapted Fellowship of the Ring. So there's one.
Okay. There you go.
That's another one. We probably could spend a long time just talking about that and then not talking about Two Towers. Well, thanks to both of you for spending so much time. I know you have very busy schedules, and I really appreciate it. I probably should have only asked for two movies. Then we could have actually spent only an hour on it.
I really like how this is all unfolded. I have a lot of things I want to go back and revisit. So,
yeah, I thought there were going to be certain films that on the list that we would talk about at length, but we didn't, and I'm glad we didn't. This was more interesting, probably. So, yeah. Thank you for your creative lists and your thoughtful explorations of those. I really appreciate the time and really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
All right. Well, thanks so much to Jeffrey Overstreet and Stephen Graydanis for joining me here on the podcast. That was such a fun conversation because, as I said at the top, these are two of my very favorite subjects, movies and books and the intersection thereof. So that was a great time for me. Hope you really enjoyed listening to that. Remember, Stephen Graydanis can be found at decentfilms.com and Jeffrey Overstreet can be found at lookingcloser.org. They're both on Twitter as well, and you can find them on Letterboxd if you want to do that as well. Look at some of their ongoing reviews and reflections. Well, as always, thanks so much to everyone who's been listening. Don't forget about the other great content here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. Right now, we're going through Julius Caesar over on The Plays the Thing. We're discussing The Spy Who Came in from the Cold over on Close Reads, our flagship show. And of course, there's The Daily Poem, where every day we are bringing you a new poem. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for being a part of the conversation. Thanks for being a part of this community. I'm David Kern. Be back next week with another episode of Libromania.